The move to restrict what is read in the library, and a rebirth in downtown Rock Island being brought back from the dead in the cities. Rock Island is celebrating a rebirth, just in time for it to celebrate being back from the dead. We'll explain that coming up. But first, the cities are marking Monday, October 6th, as 2025 Banned Book Readout Day. It kicks off a week-long Banned Books Week organized by the American Library Association. Last year, more than 2,400 different titles were challenged. The Library Association says that's the third largest number of challenges ever documented by the association. The average was about a tenth of that each year from 2001 to the year 2020. So what's behind the challenges? And what is done before a book even hits your local library shelves? I was joined by Rock Island Public Library Director Angela Campbell and the Executive Director of the Midwest Writer Center, Ryan Collins. So Banned Books Readout kind of kicks off Banned Books Week. Mm-hmm. What is the readout all about on October 6th?
We're just drawing attention to the First Amendment and the right to read. So what we do is have people come in and they read selections from their favorite challenged or banned books that have happened across the United States. And it just shows that, you know, people can have discourse without, you know, and disagree without having any problems. It's a conversation. It's just drawing, you have that right. The First Amendment is the First Amendment for a reason. It's the basis of our democracy, and we want to protect that.
Well, and we started off the program by pointing out that the American Library Association says challenges to books are 10 times greater now mm-hmm. than they were, you know, between the years 2000 and 2020. Mm-hmm. What's going on?
I think that, you know, there's definitely some politics behind it. There are organizations that have bound together to try to get behind banning books. There are places that library boards have been appointed with that sole purpose. So it feels like if you don't agree with certain folks, then you're canceled or banned. And books are the same, videos, listening, you know, all of that. So it's important that we stand up for that First Amendment right to read, listen, and view.
Well, you, of course, run a library. You're mm-hmm. in charge of distribution. Mm-hmm. Ryan, you're on the other side where you're with the writers and the creation. Mm-hmm. What kind of a chilling effect is this having right now?
I mean, for the writers that I know and that I'm privileged to, like, be in conversation with about this kind of stuff, I think they're more emboldened than anything else. I don't think, dissent and critique and, like, a lot of those things start in writing before they maybe make their way to other art forms, you know, like screenwriting, you know, like film requires, you know, scripts and things like that. So, like, writing's pretty foundational to all that. I think it becomes more of an issue in terms of who's going to put the work out and who's willing to support challenging work, work that maybe is of a dissenting view in whatever kind of way, or maybe deals with topics that people just don't want to deal about because of their own discomfort or ignorance or unwillingness to engage other people about that which they maybe don't have that much experience about. So I think writers are going to be just fine being able to find the outlets to get the work to the audience. I think that might be a struggle, and, you know, we'll kind of see what publishers are willing to, like, stand by those writers so that they can have their product to sell to the public.
A lot of the objections, of course, are towards LGBTQ books or you know, real strong sexual content books, and whether or not it should be available to all members of society, the young as well as the old. Where do you draw the line on something like that? I mean, the right to produce it is one thing. The right to distribute it is quite another.
Yeah, I mean, a good friend of mine, a writer friend of mine, once, you know, she was talking about her own children, and she said something that I thought was pretty salient. She said, if they're old enough to ask, they're old enough to know. Meaning that if her kids have questions, she wants to be open and honest with them and, like, be the source of information and try to help them get good information, as opposed to having things that they just don't talk about, which leads to going to other sources of information that are harder to sort of maybe account for, might have like negative effects, might be bad information. So I think there is like a social obligation to make information as widely available as possible. And then it's, you know, it's up to people if they don't want to engage with this or that content, you know, that's fine. Nobody's forcing that on them. But like, there's a market interest in it being out there. There's an educational interest being out there. There's a self-expression interest in that being out there. And based on all of these fronts, and you know, given you know our foundational document, it's the First Amendment, not the Fifth or Sixth. So I think there needs to be a space for that. I think there's always been a space for that. And I think that's part of what has made this country great.
Well, and Angela, you don't just get a book in a box and you put it on the shelf.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about the process because, I mean, you review the books before they're distributed.
Yes. We have a multi-page collection development policy that our librarians follow. And, in fact, when you're in library school, you take a very long class on how to select items and, you know, delete items from the library. Weeding is what we call it. And there's some guidelines that they follow that it has to be reviewed, mainly because millions of things are published every year and there's no way a library could own everything. So we have to look at our community and see, you know, what sorts of things they're most interested in, what sorts of things the public comes in and asks for. Our collection would be totally different than Silvis or Coal Valley or something. We're Rock Island, and that's who we serve, so we have to be very cognizant of the types of items that we put on the shelf for our citizens. So,
and what happens if something is challenged?
Challenged? Well, it's changed over the last few years. We used to have a reconsideration of materials, form, and policy, but the Secretary of State of Illinois, who is actually the state librarian, and the governor worked on a bill to ban book bans. And so if public libraries, we receive a per capita aid grant, our state funding every year. If public libraries don't adopt that mentality of banning book bans, then we don't get our funding.
And let's be honest, I mean, you're an Illinois library.
Yes.
You know it's very different on the other side of the river in
yes.
Iowa, where, as you point out, Illinois actually made a law that mm-hmm. you cannot ban books, very specific, mm-hmm. whereas Iowa seems to be allowing greater objections to materials. Tell me what, you got to be happier to be an Illinois librarian? I mean, I know you probably talk to your brethren on the other side of the river, I guess is what I'm getting
at. I do. I feel really bad for our colleagues because when you go to library school, you definitely learn all of this, the First Amendment and giving access to quality information to people and letting people decide what they want to read, view, or listen to. So I totally am on board if a parent doesn't want a child to read something, that is their right, absolutely. Or if somebody checks something out and doesn't like it, I mean, my joke is if it was all science fiction, I'd want to ban it because I don't like to read science fiction. So, you know, but we have to have everything for everybody. And the Iowa folks, I think the public libraries are standing strong. I haven't heard of a lot of issues except for them lawsuits against librarians that they're providing pornography or they're, you know, giving things to children that the parents don't want them to read ultimately. But I don't know what people's lives are like or what shoes they walk in. Obviously, some of the books that you had mentioned, LGBTQ, incest, rape type stories that are true, especially, or else fictionalized so people can understand them better. There's people that go through that, and especially young people. And to have somebody publish a book that speaks to them so they can have help, so they know that they're not alone, has saved lives. And so I look at it that way, that not everyone's going to want to read it. That's fine. But it's there for those who maybe need some support and aren't getting it elsewhere, and to know that they're not alone. So hopefully, I can't say what's going to happen in Iowa, but it is a 180-degree difference.
Well, and Ryan, talk about that, because, I mean, you deal with this every single day, people pouring out their souls, people basically therapeutically on paper with pen, telling some of their deepest, darkest concerns and fears.
Yeah, I mean, it's necessary. Like, I think writing, among a lot of other things, is a tool for thinking. And if you can't write freely, I don't think you can think freely, which means you can't ask questions that you might need to ask about your life and living in the world, which is a hard thing to do. And yeah, historically, like all throughout history, not just our culture, all cultures, storytelling is one way that we do that, whether it be highly fictionalized or whether it be something that's very close to the bone and very real. And I think what people forget is these people who want to ban books, be they elected officials or, you know, private individuals and organizations or whatever, I think they forget sometimes that what they're talking about is what they want. And they think what they want should stand in for everybody else. And that's the exact opposite of being free and having choice, which seems to be things that they also say that they want. So it's confusing, but it's also like missing the point. We're not having a conversation about these texts. A lot of times people who want to ban books haven't actually read the books. And in fact, I know there were districts in the state of Iowa that were using AI just to sort of scan for content and sort of, you know, keywords, right? Mm-hmm. So we're not really having a conversation about what these books are or what they do or what they say. They just are seen to be and have, you know, in the eyes of some people, objectionable material, and that makes it objectionable for everybody. And I think they need to check themselves and realize like what they're doing is actually very selfish in terms of thinking about what I want is what everybody wants. I don't think that's true for anybody and probably much of anything.
Yeah. Ban Book Week has been going on. I mean, you've done it for a number of years.
Yeah.
Are you preaching to the choir or what do you really hope is accomplished?
I mean, we hope we can get a mix of people, librarians, teachers, artists, community members, activists together to, you know, celebrate these books that we love that have been important to us, but also to draw some attention to the fact that, this has been quietly going on for a while. I think like a lot of things, people have been taken aback by the number of book bans like that you mentioned earlier, that they've shot up in recent years. But this is, you know, like anything else, it sort of builds slowly. And so I think the more events there are like this, you know, not just during Banned Books Week, but all the time, that we're, you know, putting a focus on writers and self-expression and people who, you know, have something to say that maybe not everybody agrees with, but maybe it's worth everybody engaging with a little bit. And like, we can't engage with that which is not available to us or which is being concealed or hidden. And so, if we want to be a free and open society, this is important.
Absolutely. And I think what's really unnerving right now is the content used to be, like I say, specific things were red flags. Now they're just stopping actual history from being published. I mean, things that really happened. And, you know, if you ban one thing, it's a snowball effect. Everything starts to be questioned exactly the way Ryan said. I mean, it doesn't fit in with their values or this and that and the other, but it is happening. So, I mean, we want to have books on the shelf that are historically accurate, that come from all sides. And that's one of the things the librarians always look for, too.
Well, and as part of the readout, there's going to be books that will be, or sections of books that will be read out loud.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, tell me a little bit about those books. I mean, some of the titles may surprise people because they're relatively mainstream.
I mean, you have things as all of the classics that you would consider classics, so To Kill a Mockingbird, Fahrenheit 451, all of those have been challenged in some way, shape, or form. But even things like the Bible have been, because, you know, there are sections of that people don't agree with. So it really the children's books are kind of shocking sometimes. I know I read The Lorax once, and because that had been challenged in California, the forestry industry didn't like how they were presented in the book. So, I mean, the reasons really vary.
Which, yeah, I mean, like, that's the thing that strikes me more than any one particular title, because I think people return to books that are familiar, like Toni Morrison's Beloved, 1984. Mm-hmm. These are books that are commonly read at these kind of events. But, like, the children's books and, like, recent children's books, I think that's the really striking thing when you look at these lists of books that are being banned. So many of them are, like, books that are written for children that are maybe about kind of, like, difficult or touchy subjects. Yeah, like death, you know, like Bridge to Terabithia is one book. And like, I was kind of shocked when I first found out that that was banned. And then I found out it was banned because it talked about death. And I was like, well, children don't have to experience that. Like, what, we don't want to make a space where we can have a healthy conversation about that, like, and utilize a creative text to maybe help us do that. That, as a parent and an educator and a writer, seems misguided to me. So. Yeah, the children's books always kind of jump out.
Yeah, for sure.
Our thanks to Rock Island Public Library Director Angela Campbell and the Executive Director of the Midwest Writers Center, Ryan Collins. The Banned Books Readout featuring Stephen Pico is Monday, October 6th from 6 until 8 at the Rock Island Library's Watts Midtown branch. That's on 30th Street. A social time and networking starts at 5:30. Still to come, bringing downtown Rock Island back from the dead. But first, the events that are kicking off October in the cities, thanks to Visit Quad Cities.
Check out the things to do this week in the Quad Cities. Start your week off by attending the QC Flavor Fest. Sample food and drinks made here in the Quad Cities. Also on October 2nd, check out Taste of East Moline. Try food from 27 local restaurants. Then Major League Fishing's Phoenix Bass Fishing League Regional Tournament is returning to the QC. Then enjoy the free Fall Festival at Nahant Marsh. There will be games, music, and a petting zoo. Finally, enjoy the Line Dance Party at the Landing Ice Rink on October 4th. For more events like these, check out our events calendar at visitquadcities.com.
An almost $9 million downtown infrastructure renovation is now finished in downtown Rock Island, just in time to celebrate the Halloween season. So it's time to bring back the dead, a party whose name is not lost on the downtown merchants who are sponsoring it. It's coming up next weekend, October 11th and 12th. Rock Island Downtown Alliance Executive Director Jack Cullen joined us to talk about the big downtown changes. So Back from the Dead is coming up. It's October 11th through the 12th, and I was looking, I mean, everybody, it seems, is involved in downtown Rock Island.
We're excited about this.
Yeah.
I think it shows how our businesses are embracing some of the authentic amenities and assets in downtown Rock Island. And, you know, it started with two major haunted attractions, Terror at Skellington Manor, closer to the west end of downtown, right, and then on the east end, Shock House at the QCCA Expo Center, and figuring out how do we fill in the gaps there. And businesses are embracing the spooky season in downtown Rock Island, and here we are with Back from the Dead, second year.
It is coming at a time that the renovation of downtown Rock Island is complete. You know what? Talk about this, because it's just infrastructure. It's just roads and improving lighting, but it is so much more for a downtown like Rock Island.
Yes, and to make the connection to Back from the Dead, I have to give credit to downtown business owner Brandy Vandiwally, owner of Skeleton Key Art and Antiques. And she had the idea for this name of Back from the Dead, again, embracing the spooky season in downtown, but to show that our businesses are showing up for progress and to show those around us that downtown Rock Island is back, and we are celebrating that. And yes, we are on the heels of the largest, single largest investment in downtown's public infrastructure in a generation. There were roads that were reconstructed, but we have a lot of amenities that were built as part of that project. It's not your typical infrastructure improvement, meaning that we have beautiful new signage, large-scale murals that went up in Arts Alley, a lot of pieces of that project that were designed to enhance public spaces, improve quality of life, and to really get people excited and proud about the heart of Rock Island.
Because it's more than just street work and
yes,
sidewalks, because it's creating basically a festival area when it's not a major street.
Yes, enhancing that sense of place for the community is a big goal of this project. Right in the center of downtown, center of the Rebuild Downtown project area, is the 1800 block of 2nd Avenue. Businesses on that block include El Patron Mexican Restaurant and Bar, Soy 2, the former Ribco, and you know, the idea there is that it was formerly a pedestrian mall, mm-hmm. and we wanted to balance the pedestrian-friendly aspects of that while enhancing access to that street. So what we have now is a shared street or festival street concept, 25-foot wide sidewalks on both sides, no curb, and bollards on each end of the block that make it easy to shut down for regular events, such as the QC Farmers Market that started there this season, which has been great.
This is really unique to the Quad City area. I mean, it's a concept that, because you had the district, and you said it was a pedestrian mall, and this almost brings it an updated version of that.
Yes, it is really that balance of, you know, increasing access for maintenance, emergency vehicles, you know, regular vehicle access, again, while maintaining the pedestrian-friendly traits there. There's no curb, again, no trip hazards, easy to shut down for events. The vendors at the farmers market pull right up onto the sidewalk, and patrons are welcome to walk through the middle of the street. There's an adjacent green lawn, which makes it extra inviting, so it's not just a concrete jungle. We have the brand new Rock Island letters that's become a great photo op. And then on the green lawn, we put additional seating and outdoor games and other activities adjacent to the farmers market. So it's become a nice gathering spot. And I think it surprises people who haven't been downtown for some time when they visit for the farmers market or second Saturdays on 2nd Ave, which has become a monthly event adjacent to the farmers market this season.
Also kind of an extension for Schwieber Park as well.
Exactly. I mean,
it just kind of all ties in that way.
Yes.
Are you expecting, and of course you are, more festivals, more type of events, more family-friendly activities that are planned for like this summer?
Definitely. I think Back from the Dead is an example of that. We've also seen an uptick in interest from the community of using these spaces. You know, we have the Green Lawn, this new festival street, as well as Arts Alley, which has been renovated, where we hosted our holiday market. We've hosted some different pop-up mm-hmm. events in that space, and we'll continue to do so. But we're seeing community organizations, such as the Rock Island Public Library Foundation, during Back from the Dead, will be hosting a party in that space, in addition to partnering with the next door neighboring business, The Iconic. So I think we're excited about seeing more programs happening in these renovated spaces, again, as an extension from Schwieber Park.
And the key also, of course, is to spark business activity and economic growth in the downtown area. Are you starting to see, because the merchants went through a lot to get to this point, an almost $8 million, more than $8 million renovation, and they had to deal with the construction and all that. Now the construction is done, are you seeing more interest in businesses and others looking to come downtown?
Yeah, number one, we're trying to ensure that our existing businesses have the support and resources that they need to thrive. That's vital, especially coming off a large construction project that did make it challenging at times for operations. And so that's number one priority. In addition, one of the major goals of this large infrastructure improvement project was to encourage private investment. And so we are seeing that private investment from existing building owners and business owners, which is fantastic, in addition to seeing some new faces come downtown and purchase real estate, looking to open new businesses in the Central Business District. So that's obviously exciting. It comes at a good time. The city's downtown TIF has been reestablished, so there are additional financial assistance and incentives available. And Rock Island is taking advantage of a new statewide legislation, the city, the River's Edge Redevelopment Zone as well, which is a boost in historic tax credits. So it's a great time to look to invest in downtown Rock Island with those incentives. And I think just the momentum that is starting to build again on the heels of this major project.
But once again, the key is Back from the Dead, October 11th through the 12th, second year, so it's
yes.
growing. But what a nice way to really kick off the end of the construction.
It is, where you know everything is open And a cool part of that event are these walking tours that really highlights some of the notorious history of downtown Rock Island.
Yeah, we got to talk about the gangsters and the Looney era and
exactly.
all that, because Rock Island's got a phenomenal history.
It really does. That's one of, I think, a unique part of our brand and something that we're trying to lean into, not to glorify some of that, you know,
the
violent past.
Yeah.
However, it is part of our authentic history.
Yeah.
And so how do we tell that story in an appropriate way? I think one way is through these gangsters and ghost tours led by Minda Powers Douglas.
Yeah.
And we're excited about that being part of Back from the Dead, learning about, again, some of those landmarks downtown and the connections to that notorious past.
Our thanks to Rock Island Downtown Alliance Executive Director Jack Cullen. America is getting ready for its 250th birthday next year, but we're already celebrating. Throughout the year, leading up to the 4th of July, we're asking local community leaders about their civic spark, why they've chosen their careers, and how their work is improving our lives. We pose that question to State Representative Greg Johnson, Democrat from East Moline. What is your civic spark?
My spark for me, it took me 38 years to really find purpose in my life. I had always helped a lot of people. I'd always been very active politically with my union and other social groups. But my father dying gave me just even more purpose. And I realized I had to double down on that. In order to help people, I had to get very engaged. I continued to ascend through my local, ended up becoming political chair for AFSCME, and realized that if you want to get things done and you want to build a better world, You have to advocate. You have to do work.
Our thanks to State Representative Greg Johnson. On the air, on the radio, on the web, on your mobile device, and streaming on your computer, thanks for taking some time to join us as we talk about the issues on the cities.